Yes, I'm very pleased to be in your midst. I'm glad to be in your midst and feel the fellowship with you. I must honestly say the subject was not the subject I chose myself. My colleague is in the midst, so when I make serious mistakes, he can correct me. Or when I am completely at loss. You've asked me to give an overview of the church history in the Netherlands in about an hour. I would ask you how you would feel you to do this for Scotland, also when you are expected to explain the background of divisions and unions within the Church of the Reformation. But I will try to do it and concentrate on what I think is really important for a foreigner to know about the church history in the Netherlands, to understand the present situation. The chart I gave is to understand the situation since the 19th century, but I will not explain all the details, for it is very confusing, even for a Dutchman. There was already some Christian presence in what is now the most southern parts of the Netherlands in the Roman time. But Christianity really reached the Netherlands in the 17th century. We can mention then two names who brought Christianity by the grace of Christ to the Netherlands: Willibrordus, coming from Northumbria, and Bonifacius, born in Exeter. The Christianity brought to the Netherlands was, as everywhere in Western Europe during the Middle Ages, of a Roman Catholic character, although this is more true of Bonifacius than of Willibrordus. We have also in the Netherlands a pre-Reformation movement called the Modern Devotion. The most famous work from this movement is The Imitation of Christ, written by Thomas à Kempis. It is a nice book. It concentrates on fellowship with God, on a brokenness of heart, but it is still in the context of Roman Catholic doctrine. Already the title indicates that imitation of Christ, and not so much Christ as complete Savior. In the 16th century, the Netherlands were touched by the Reformation. And then it is important to know that the Netherlands, indeed, they also include what we now call Belgium. The Belgic Confession is actually the Dutch Confession of Faith. Our country was called in that days the Northern Netherlands and Belgium the Southern Netherlands. And in the first part of the 16th century, the 17 provinces of the Netherlands had all Charles V as their prince, being Earl of the one province, Duke of the other province, and so on. Charles V was also Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire and King of Spain. Within the Holy Roman Empire, the 17 provinces of the Netherlands had a special status, forming together the so-called Burgundian sphere of district. Already at the beginning of the reign of Charles V, the teaching of the great reformer Martin Luther touched the Netherlands. Actually, the first two martyrs were Augustinian friars from Antwerp. And the first martyr in the Northern Netherlands was a priest who had begun to preach justification by faith alone. Formally, this man still belonged to the Roman Catholic Church just a few hours before they died. Then they were officially excommunicated and put to death. But formally, they were still Roman Catholic. They were Roman Catholic who embraced the new doctrine, you know. Especially in the northern part of the Netherlands, there was also a strong influence of a peaceful form of Anabaptism. We speak about the so-called Mennonites. Their spiritual leader was Menno Simons, a former Roman Catholic priest from Friesland. And most of the martyrs of the 16th century in the Netherlands came from their circles. Some were Lutheran, some were Reformed people, but most of the martyrs were from the circles of the Mennonites. From about 50, 50, 40 and onwards, we see the influence of Calvinistic and Reformed teaching in the Netherlands. And I remind you again, it is both the Netherlands now and Belgium. Because in first instance, there was more influence of Reformed teaching and doctrine in the southern part, in what is now Belgium, than in the northern part. Because the government did not tolerate any form of Christian religion outside the existing Roman Catholic Church, Reformed Christian formed underground or semi-underground congregations. The persecution became heavier under the reign of Philip II, son and successor of Charles V, not as emperor, but he succeeded his father as King of Spain and Prince of the 17 provinces of the Netherlands. Actually, the so-called Belvedere Confession, published in 1561, was directed to Philip II to make plain that Reformed Christianity is Catholic Christianity in its Reformed form. It is really Catholic Christianity, and not Roman Catholic is not Catholic at all. And that was the point of view, and I agree with it. The author was Guido de Bray, a young man who was initially touched by the teaching of Luther and later came under the influence of Reformed teaching, and he studied some years under the supervision of Calvin theology in Geneva. He was hanged for his faith. Because of the severe persecution under Philip II, quite a lot of Reformed Christians fled abroad and formed their congregations of exiles. In England, but also in the Protestant part of Germany. And that is the explanation that we as the Church of the Netherlands have the Catechism of Heidelberg in our constitution. Congregations of Reformed exiles in the electorate, one of the principalities of the Holy Roman Empire of Pals, came in contact with the Catechism of Heidelberg, published in 1563 and translated it into Dutch. Actually, the first General Assembly of the Dutch Reformed Church, and that was the official name, that became the official name, was held in Germany, in the county of East Friesland. That was 1571. And from that on, the Catechism of Heidelberg and the Belgian Confession of Faith were the official constitution of the Church. Then already an uprising of war was started against Philip II. Officially, it was not against the king, but against his wrong advisors. William, Prince of Orange, who had been stadtholder of Philip II for the provinces Holland and Zeeland, was its leader. Perhaps I can explain it. Our country is often called Holland, but Holland actually was one of the most important provinces, especially in the north. So, William of Orange was stadtholder of Philip II for the counties of Holland and Zeeland, and he was the leader of the revolt. The reasons for the revolt were diverse, not only religious, but also economic and political. But very soon, the core of supporters, already from the start, I must say, of William, Prince of Orange, was formed by Reformed Christians. It became a struggle for religious freedom. William of Orange had a God-fearing mother, was brought up as a Lutheran. Later, he became a Roman Catholic. Only a nominal Christian, I must say. It was for political reasons that he changed to Roman Catholicism to receive the Princedom of Orange. Then he returned to Lutheranism, and finally in 1573 he professed the Reformed faith by partaking the Lord's Supper in the congregation of the Dutch Reformed Church of Dordrecht. From 1572 and onwards, several cities in the north became free and chose the site of the Prince of Orange. In the parts of the Netherlands that became free, the Dutch Reformed Church became the official church protected by the government. You know that the principle of establishment. And in 1574, a synod which was a kind of semi-national synod was held in Dordrecht. A second one. And that was the first. That was an actual national synod in 1578. And the famous Synod of Dordt is actually the third Synod of Dordt held in that city. The third national synod. When you count the first one, the semi-national, also as a national city. The outcome of the war against Philip II was that the northern part of the 17 provinces became a republic. The so-called Republic of the Seven United Netherlands. And the southern part, now Belgium, remained under the government of the King of Spain. some 200,000 to 300,000 Reformed Christians fled from the south to the north. And I also mentioned that in the second part of the 17th century, many French Protestants fled to the Netherlands. That explains that several Reformed Christians in the Netherlands have French-sounding names. We can say that the history of the Netherlands as an independent nation, independent state, and the history of the Dutch Reformed Church are closely connected. And we can also add a relationship with the House of Orange. The Prince of Orange and members of his family got some of the highest positions in the Dutch Republic, while in 1813, the House of Orange was offered the kingship over the newly formed Dutch kingdom. Groen van Prinster, a famous 19th century Christian member of parliament and historian, said that the Dutch Reformed Church and the Dutch state were born as twins in the struggle with Spain for the freedom to worship God in accordance with his word. So in the Republic of the Seven United Netherlands, the Reformed Church was protected by the state. The state paid the salaries of the ministers and the buildings and so on. It was the church established by law. Mennonites, which we found especially in the most northern provinces, and Lutherans were tolerated. And the Lutherans you found in some of the bigger cities. In less degree, there was some toleration for Roman Catholics. The Dutch territories below the so-called Great Rivers were almost completely Roman Catholic, never touched by the Reformation. And it is also true for several regions north of the so-called Great Rivers. But especially below the Great Rivers, the Roman Catholic population of the Netherlands starts. I now come to the 17th century, the century of the Synod of Dort, but also the century of the rise of the Dutch Second Reformation, Dutch Further Reformation, you can also say Dutch Puritanism. What was very important, not only for the Dutch Reformed Church, but also for the whole Reformed Church in Europe, and for Reformed Christianity until now, was the Synod of Dort, the Third Synod hold in that city, the Synod of Dort of 1618-1619. It was more than a national synod because members of other Reformed churches in Europe were invited. You can say it was in fact a kind of international Reformed synod. The reason was strife about the teaching of Arminius, first one of the pastors of the Reformed congregation of Amsterdam, and later professor of theology at the University of Leiden. I need not to explain his teachings. Arminius denied absolute predestination, the irresistibility of grace. He taught a kind of general atonement, and he denied the perseverance of the saints. Arminius himself died in 1609, but after his death, his followers continued to propagate his teaching. A great turmoil in the Reformed Church was the result. And the Synod of Dort made an end to this turmoil. The teachings of the Arminians were condemned. And the most important fruit of this synod was a third confession, the so-called five articles against the Remonstrants or the Arminians, and the other name is the Canons of Dort. The Synod of Dort upholded the Reformed faith of free grace. And from then on, the Canons of Dort, together with the Belgian Confession and the Catechism of Heidelberg, formed the official constitution of the Dutch Reformed Church. Together they are called the three forms, little booklets, of unity. The three short writings in which the one Reformed Catholic faith is confessed. At the Synod of Dort, the Reformed doctrine was safeguarded. But we must not think that all members and even not all ministers of this church exemplified Reformed piety. Many of the common People just came to the Lord's Supper as they and their forefathers partook the Mass. The Sabbath was desecrated in a large measure. Quite a lot of its ministers, although professing and preaching the Reformed faith, did really show that they knew its power. And then already around the time of the Synod of Dort, we see the beginnings of a movement that has got the name the Further Reformation. I mention a few important representatives of that first generation of theologians belonging to the Further Reformation. The first one is an Englishman, William Ames, an English Puritan, who became professor of theology in Franeker, and who also was an assistant of the moderator of the Synod of Dort. His lectures at the University of Franeker in Friesland influenced a new generation of pastors. Another important name is Gisbertus Fuchsius. As a minister of Heusden, he attended the Synod of Dort and he was its youngest member. He is one of the most important leaders and promoters of the Further Reformation in his first stage. In 1634, he became a professor of theology and Oriental languages at the newly formed University of Utrecht. In his inaugural address, he said that the real aim is to combine of ministerial training is to combine academic training with piety. Piety and insight combined. And then a third name, William Tayling, he is sometimes called the father of the Further Reformation. He came from a wealthy family in Zeeland, son of the major of Zierikzee. He initially studied law in Leiden, in France. He was brought to a deeper knowledge of Christ during his stay in Banbury, connected with his visit to the University of Cambridge. Confronted with the Puritan piety, he felt that his Christianity was somewhat superficial, and he was deeply influenced by it. He decided to give up the pursuit of law and to become a minister of the gospel. Tayling promoted the translation of Puritan authors in Dutch. He translated himself several works, and he wrote tens of books in which we feel how much he was influenced by the English Puritans. The aim of the Further Reformation was to promote practical and experimental piety. The Puritan view of the Sabbath was propagated by the men of the Further Reformation. And what we see in the 17th century is a more purely Orthodox Reformed wing in the church and a wing connected with the Further Reformation, which can be characterized as pietistic in a positive sense, evangelistic, experimental. I must emphasize that the borders between the two wings were fluent. But to realize that there were at least two tendencies already in the 17th century is important to understand church history during the centuries. Until now, we see Reformed denominations doctrinally orthodox but lacking the experimental emphasis, and other denominations or rings of denominations being not only orthodox in doctrine but stressing the importance of practical and experimental piety. Not only the English but also the Scottish practical and experimental writers have been important for the Dutch Reformed Church. Many of their works were translated in Dutch. From your fellow Scotsmen, I mention from the 17th century Samuel Rutherford, Andrew Gray, William Guthrie, Hugh Binney. From the 18th century, Thomas Boston and the Erskine Brothers. From the 19th century, Robert Murray McShane. And especially the works of Boston, Erskine and Robert Murray McShane were widely read until now. And I can also name his work are not so widely read, but they are valued and loved. That is the autobiography of Murdoch Campbell and his book In All Their Afflictions. They are translated in Dutch. And they represent a form of reformed piety that is very akin to the piety in the more experimental circles of the reformed church of the Netherlands. I now come to the 18th century, the century of decline and revival. At the end of the 17th century, we see already the first signals of decline and departure from reformed teaching. Although officially every minister was obliged to teach reformed teaching, when you became a candidate to the ministry, you had to sign formally that your views were in full agreement with the three forms of unity. But the practice became somewhat different. In the 18th century, we did not only see the first signs of theological liberalism in the Dutch Reformed Church, this was also a century of revival, although not on such a large scale as in the Anglo-Saxon world. We can say that in the Netherlands, generally speaking, the work of the Holy Spirit had a more quiet nature than in the Anglo-Saxon world. But certainly there was a continuing stream of genuine conversions. In the 18th century, more than the Reformed Church, the Mennonites came under liberal influence, at least their leaders. At the local level, many conservative Mennonites were reading works of the writers of the Second Reformation and translations of English and Scottish writers, and many Mennonites in the 18th century joined the national church because they found the preaching there more akin to to the Bible. That seems a strange development, but it really happened. Also in the 19th century. And the Mennonites almost disappeared. A small remnant was left that was completely liberal. What's also important to mention, it happened already in the 18th, in the 17th century, what we call conventicles. And what are conventicles? Conventicles are gatherings of pious Christians who gather in homes and speak with each other, sometimes a sermon is read first, about the dealings of the Lord with their souls. Was the local minister a promoter of practical and experimental piety, he often stimulated these conventicles and participated himself in them. In such cases, the relationship between local conventicles and the local congregation of the Reformed Church has a friendly character. This remained true in quite a couple of cases in the 18th century. But in the 18th century, we see also more and more that Christians come together in conventicles because of the spiritual poverty in the local congregations. And in some cases, they came only to church, these Christians, when one of the children was to be baptized. They came to the communion service, but most of the time, during church service, they read a sermon at home, together with their families. And sometimes there was a man in our midst who gave some commands. And that's also important for understanding the church history of the Netherlands, the conventicles and their spirituality. I must honestly confess that in the 18th century, sometimes reformed piety got a somewhat unhealthy introspective character. Too much stress was given to the marks of grace at the expense of the promise of the gospel and its free and unfettered offer. It's a question of balance, you know. We see in the latter part of the 18th century the first signals of incipient hyper-Calvinism. Again, I must say, in practice you have all kinds of variations. A somewhat inclination to hyper-Calvinism, a somewhat unbalanced preaching, but still a blessed preaching, and so on. But I just mentioned tendencies. At the end of the 18th century, the Republic of the 17 United Netherlands came to an end. The Prince of Orange went in exile to England, and a vassal Republic of France came in place of the Republic of the 7 United Netherlands. And finally, our country ended up as a part of the French Empire. The period of 1795 to 1813 is known in church in Dutch history as the Friends period or the Friends time. The relationship between the Dutch Reformed Church and the government came to an end. There came full freedom for all religious groups and not longer one church protected by law. In 1813, the Prince of Orange came back and now he became king of the new formed Kingdom of the Netherlands. But the relationship between the Reformed Church and the government was not restored. Although the government started again to pay the salaries of the ministers, and in practice continued to have an influence. Advised by his liberal ministers, King William I gave in 1816 the church a new church order. No longer were candidates to the ministry obliged to expect full agreement with the three forms of unity. The way in which the formula was phrased was deliberately ambiguous. You could understand your signing, I agree with the confession because it is in accordance with the word of God, but it was so formulated that you could also understand it, I agree with the confession insofar as it is in agreement with the word of God. You know, then you go out our directions. Until the 19th century, the Reformed Church of the Netherlands retained its unity. You had the Lutherans, you had the Mennonites, there were the Roman Catholics. When I concentrate on the Protestant, the Lutherans, the Mennonites, but the Reformed Church was a unity. We see a fragmentation in the 19th century, and now you come to the chart, but I will not explain all the details. And I will also say that until 2004, I belonged to the National Reformed Church. So, more or less, I tell it from this perspective. In 2004, the National Reformed Church entered into union with the Reformed Churches of the Netherlands. That was the greatest dissenting body. And the Evangelical Lutheran Church to form the Protestant Church in the Netherlands. A small minority of the national church did not enter into the union and continued as the restored Reformed Church. And I belong to that church and serves, as you know, as you heard, part-time as minister of a local congregation, and the other time I'm a lecturer at the Theological Seminary of a church in Amsterdam. When you see your chart, I mention three names: Afscheiding, Ledeboeriaanse Gemeente, you can see it, and Doleantie. There were three movements, people leaving the National Church. The first one happened in 1834, the so-called secession in Dutch Afscheiding. Five ministers and one divinity student left the National Church. There were some splits among these churches, but in 1869, most of them united to form the Christian Reformed Church. Then, in 1841, the Reverend Ledeboer, a very remarkable, a somewhat eccentric man, left the Reformed Church. And around his person, a whole circle of congregation was formed, although small compared to the secession churches. One of the characteristics became that their ministers were not expected to receive an academic training. And that was even seen as wrong. You received a calling, say, 1 week, the church session and the presbytery accepted you, and a few months later you were preaching. That was how they did it. And then finally, in 1868, Abraham Kuyper and his adherents left the Dutch Reformed Church. Abraham Kuyper, known all over the world. When he was born, it's just a story, he had somewhat a great head, and his mother was afraid he had what we call a water head. And the medical doctor said, be not afraid, that is all brain. And history proved that. This movement was called the Doleantie. In all cases, In all cases, the reason that people left the Reformed National Church was that although the three forms of unity still form the constitution, its doctrines were not upheld, and false doctrines and heresies were tolerated. The movement of secession, and also, even more, the congregation around Ladywood were especially popular among the lower classes of societies. And in many cases, their congregation had their root in the conventicles. And now I come back to the conventicles. In many cases, a conventicle was changed in a congregation. That makes clear how the secession church could grew so soon. It was soon to be found in most part of the Netherlands. A sad point is that ministers of the secession, and also the Reverend Ladeboer, and members of their congregation were in first instance persecuted. They had to pay fines. Several ministers were put in prison for some time. And that was all done by the liberal elite of the Netherlands. What was the argument? Our constitution, our national constitution, said that there was religious freedom for all existing religious persuasions. And then the judges argued in the following way, that the seceders were not an existing, but a new religious persuasion. And that was the way they argued. Groen van Prinser, I mentioned him already. The faith in Netherlands, very famous in Christian circles because of his stance in Parliament, Groen van Prinser, who remained himself in the National Church, wrote a pamphlet in which he criticized this policy of the Church and of the government. It was a very vehemently written pamphlet. He stated that the Christian of the secession who left the National Church were not of a new persuasion, but were of the Reformed persuasion. So that although they left the outward structure of the National Reformed Church, they still belong to the National Reformed Church considered as a spiritual entity. And until now, many people not realizing that it goes back to Groen van Prinser, until now, it is a common expression in the Netherlands that the Reformed Christians you find in several denominations from together the Christians of the Reformed persuasion. And that goes back to Groen van Prinser. They are not a new persuasion, they are a part of an existing persuasion. And actually the persecution ended. The secession, and also the fact that Ladeboer left the National Reformed Church, were not planned actions. More or less, they came more spontaneously into being. This was not the case with the Doleantse. Kuiper was converted from liberalism to an orthodox form of Christianity in his first congregation. And he became a convinced Calvinist in his second congregation. It was his desire, and I really think it was his real desire, to reform the National Church and purify it from its unsound elements in doctrine and church order. We rebuild the church or we leave the church, he said. We rebuild it or we leave it. So it was a program promoted everywhere. He saw deliberately a clash with the liberal elite in the church. And this happened in 1868, the Doleantse. Some 100 ministers and about 300,000 persons left the National Reformed Church. 1886. In 1892, the congregations formed as a result of this movement, and the greatest part of the Christian Reformed Church formed the Reformed Churches in the Netherlands. The greatest dissenting body now. The United Churches had around 600,000 members and adherents. A small minority of the Christian Reformed Church declined to join the union. They actually started with three congregations and two ministers, but grew Very soon, it had after some years several 10,000 members and adherents. What was the reason? Quite a lot of people were dissatisfied with the spiritual climate that became more and more dominant in the Reformed churches of the Netherlands. The spiritual climate of the original Christian Reformed Church was heavily influenced by the teachings and writings of the theologians of the Further Reformation. The English Puritans, the Scottish experimental writers. There was a strong sense of coming eternity. The fact that the Christian is a pilgrim on earth. The necessity of personal conversion and the need of self-examination. It is true here and there we can detect tendencies to hyper-Calvinism. It is even more true of the followers of Ledeboer, not of Ledeboer himself, but of his followers. But generally we must speak of a healthy spiritual climate. Kuiper must be seen as a mixed blessing for the Dutch church in general. And according to several Reformed Dutch Christians, not a blessing at all. Kuiper organized the Christian members of parliament to a Christian party. Being a minister, he became also a member of parliament. And many Christians disagreed with that. He founded the Free University. He stimulated not only the formation of Christian schools, but also the formation of all kinds of Christian organizations to retain the Christian heritage under a neutral government. Actually, a neutral government was deferred by Kuiper. He disagreed strongly with the establishment principle. Reformed Christians, not only within but also outside the National Reformed Church, disagreed he with Kuiper. More controversial was his view on regeneration. He thought, some way or another, presupposed regeneration. When baptizing children, you do that because you presuppose that they are already born again. In practice, this led to great superficiality. People going to one of the congregations of the Reformed churches in the Netherlands were considered all as children of God. There was no call to conversion heard in many of the sermons, because all people coming to the congregation were children of God. They were baptized, walking in the ways of the Lord. And there was not a discriminating element in their preaching. Not less dangerous was the great activism of Kuiper and a great host of his followers who went even further than their master. For we must honestly say that Kuiper has also an experimental side. He was a very complex personality, but most of his followers had not. But what was the danger? Kuiper spoke not only about particular grace, and then he was a full Calvinist, but also about general grace, but he gave that, he spoke about it in a way not in accordance with original Calvinism. It was the so-called cultural mandate. There is not only particular grace, but there is also the cultural mandate. And he criticizes the theologians of the Further Reformation, the Puritans, that they neglected the cultural mandate. You have to be a Christian in art, you have to be a Christian in medicine. There is a certain element of truth in it, but one of the ministers in the Reformed churches in the Netherlands said, we fight for Christ on all areas of life. Isn't what that means? We have a Christian worldview. We fight for Christ on all areas of life. But one of the ministers said, already in 1920, I'm afraid that we have already lost, most of us have lost the battle on the most important area, the area of the heart. Experimental Christianity became very rare in the Reformed churches in the Netherlands. In practice, this emphasis had led in many cases to a great conformity to the world and to impoverishment of spiritual life. Kuiper designed himself as a neo-Calvinist. That is a Calvinist that brings the Reformed teaching in accordance with its own time. It is true, Kuiper defended the absolute authority of Scripture, rejected liberalism, accepted the Reformed teaching of grace. But when we hear the other things, his doctrine of presupposed regeneration, his view on the cultural mandate, you can perhaps realize why he is considered at best a mixed blessing by many Reformed Christians outside his newly formed denomination. Later in this lecture, I come back on developments in the Reformed churches in the Netherlands, and the greatest dissenting body. I repeat it again and again, otherwise the national church I call the Dutch Reformed Church, and the greatest dissenting body Reformed churches in the Netherlands. I already stated that Kuyper's view on regeneration was the main reason that the small minority of the Christian Reformed Church declined to enter the Union of 1892. The small minority that continued the Christian Reformed Church retained in the first 60 years of her existence the climate of the early secession and the further Reformation, reformed in doctrine combined with an emphasis on experimental and practical godliness. Since the second half of the 20th century, also in the Christian Reformed Church, there became more theological diversity. A growing number of their ministers don't have the experimental and practical emphases of a former generation. And nowadays we see here and there also more liberal influences. Among their ministers we see some, it is the most left-wing, but it is openly expressed who have a growing sympathy for Karl Barth and theologians in his line. I myself feel, and many Reformed Christians also before the split in the National Church, and many Reformed Christians in the National Church felt in practice most closely akin to the experimental wing of the Christian Reformed Church. The Christian Reformed Church now has about, just statistics, 75 members and adherents. I now come to Ledeboer. 75,000. Yes. What? 75,000. 75,000. Yes. 75,000. It's good that my friend is here. He is Christian Reformed. But 75 is not possible. No. 75,000. I now come to Ledeboer. And the first movement was the secession, then the Reverend Ledeboer, a really characteristic and remarkable man. He formed a very loosely organized denomination. Most of his congregation united in 1907 with a small minority of congregation having their origins in the secession. And one of you, when I spoke to, mentioned the name Dominic Keston, the Reverend Keston. He is the founder of what is called the Reformed Congregations, Grifmiddengemeente in Dutch. Since 1915, they give their candidates to the ministry some training, although not on an academic level. That is one of their characteristics until now. Nowadays, the level of the seminary can be compared with the level of a Bible college. I must add that they adjust their program to the individual capacities of the students. Some of the students have only secondary training, another one has a university background. Most of their ministers had a job for several years before they were permitted to follow the training for the ministry. In their circle, the authority of scriptures is upheld fully, and not deflections from Reformed doctrine are allowed. But during their history until now, there has been in their circles the problem of hyper-Calvinism. And also, some of their ministers, quite a couple of their ministers, are not clear on the intimate relationship between effectual calling, faith, and justification, giving the impression that a kind of second blessing is needed to come to full assurance of faith. But certainly, you also find in this denomination real gospel preachers and Christians who show the marks of real believers. It is also a denomination somewhat on their own. But at the other side, the members of this denomination had a leading role in founding a Christian political party, Christian schools, and Christian organizations. Kuiper was sometimes called the little Kesten was sometimes called the little Kuiper. He was more experimental, but he had some Christians in the National Reformed Church were reserved towards Kesten. He resembled too much Kuiper. The activism, but he was much more experimental. The Reformed congregations have nowadays about 110,000 members and adherents. I come back to that greatest dissenting body, the Reformed churches in the Netherlands. Although at most some 8% of the Dutch population belonged to it, they had a great influence. Members of this denomination were very active in politics and all kinds of organizations. This activism was one of the characteristics of this denomination for many years. Quite soon, and sometimes already from the start, a lot of local congregations in the Reformed churches in the Netherlands lacked the experimental emphasis that could not only be found in a congregation of the Christian Reformed Church, but also in quite a lot of congregations of the National Dutch Reformed Church. When founded, there was still a minority in this church influenced by the further Reformation, but this minority became smaller and smaller during the years. Several 10,000 of Christians left the Reformed churches in the Netherlands in the first 40 years of her existence, going to the Christian Reformed Church, going to the Reformed congregation, going to the National Reformed Church, because they did not receive spiritual food in the local congregations of the Reformed churches in the Netherlands. I must also add that intellectually they had a very influential role in the Netherlands, at the Reformed churches. Their ministers were trained either at the theological seminary in Kampen or at the theological faculty of the Free University of Amsterdam. Reformed Christians in the Netherlands, and especially ministers who did not agree with the so-called neo-Calvinistic emphasizes and climate, nevertheless profited from the solid Bible commentaries, studies in theology, historical theology, and church history written by theologians from these denominations. When this denomination developed in the second part of the 20th century in a more liberal direction, the results were felt also in other denominations. They could not longer profit from work from these circles. Very, very difficult to understand, even for a Dutchman outside this denomination, let alone for a foreigner, was a split that occurred almost at the end of the Second World War in the Reformed churches in the Netherlands. The name Klaas Schilder is connected with it, a great theologian who was a professor of systematic theology at the theological seminary in Kampen. He protested louder and louder against Kuiper's view of presupposed regeneration. But he did not go back to the Puritans. He stated that we have not to presuppose that the children of the covenant are born again. We have to proclaim they are believers. They are believers unless they reject the covenant promises. Schilder and even more most of his followers were very critical about the need of self-examination. Their view was, tell your congregation they have just to believe the promises of the covenant. And when they do that, they are saved, and we have to show that in godliness. But in practice, that was it was more moral in many cases. You can speak of an anti-experimental attitude. In practice, for common people, especially outside the circles, it was very difficult to see the difference between a Reformed church and a Reformed church liberated. It was the so-called liberation. Schilder was disciplined by the Synod. According to the National Synod of the Reformed Churches of 1944, Schilder did not full justice to the canons of Dort. Schilder did not accept it. I must honestly say that I cannot fully understand how the views of Schilder can be combined with the doctrine of perseverance of the saints. People from these churches try to explain me, but I'm always at loss to understand it. But I must say, when the Reformed churches in the Netherlands became more and more liberal, the Reformed churches liberated remained true to the authority of Scripture and to a doctrinal Reformed position. One of the characteristics was they were very, very much on their own. Their view was when you really obey Christ, you join our denomination. You dishonor Christ, so they say that it, when you do not join our denomination. That gave problems in their own circles, and there was a split in 1967. Nowadays, we see a rapid development in the wrong direction in the Reformed churches liberated. There is a great openness to neo-orthodoxy, to all kinds of more loosely forms of evangelical theology. They have given up the idea that they are the only church, true church of Christ in the Netherlands, and I'm glad about it. But they gave also up the majority of the many good things of their heritage. At the last national synod, the great majority of its members made the decision to allow women to ordain to all offices. And at the local level, there are already several congregations that allow persons having a homosexual relationship and coming to the Lord's Supper. The only sunny side I see in all these developments that the more conservative Christians within the Reformed churches liberated have now more openness than formerly towards Reformed Christians in other denominations, and in some cases also more openness to the heritage of Puritanism and further Reformation. But that is more an exception than a rule, I must say. But here and there you see that. I now come back to the national church, and we go back to the 19th century. Generally speaking, the spiritual level and preaching at the beginning of the 19th century was a very low ebb in the national church. Many of its ministers were purely liberal. There was a middle group that you could characterize as moderately or very moderately orthodox. From the side of historians who told the church history from the point of view of dissenting Reformed churches, you sometimes get the impression that at the beginning of the 19th century there were only 4, 5, or 6 faithful ministers in the National Reformed Church. And even quite a lot of common people in the National Reformed Church came to accept this point of view, because it was so often told. But the fact is that the actual situation was called darker than it really was. Also, at its lowest ebb, tens of ministers were fully reformed in preaching and doctrine, although none of them, at the beginning, in the first half of the 19th century, was a prominent theologian. I can also add that the secession awakened Reformed Christians in the National Church. Addresses were sent to the Senate to act really in accordance with the constitutions. And this was one of the arguments of Reformed Christians to stay in the National Reformed Church. Two arguments. The constitution of the church is still reformed, and at the local level, that was not in all cases for several Christians could say that here in a local congregation we have gospel preaching. The number of congregations with a faithful priesthood dramatically grew from 1867 and onward. What was the case? The church session lost the right in that year to supply completely on their own vacancies in their midst. And so you had the Orthodox congregation and the liberal church session, often the more rich people. And when there was a vacancy, they just out one of their own. In 1867, it became possible for the congregation to have a definite influence on the formation of the church session. And in a couple of years, many liberal ministers had a completely Orthodox church session. When they left accepting a call to another congregation or retired, a fully reformed minister was called in their place. For a long time, in the second part of the 19th century, there was a great shortage of really reformed ministers in the Dutch Reformed Church. The pure liberal wing came into decline. There was a great middle group, and also in the reformed wing you had several shades, one more orthodox, one more experimental. The reason that many reformed Christians stayed in the Dutch Reformed Church, that was a great disappointment for Kuyper. The middle group, he understood, would not follow him. And they were more in the broad sense of the word evangelical. But also about the half of the reformed wing did not follow him. It was a very great disappointment for Kuyper, but the reason was they didn't trust him. They found him too active, they didn't trust the spiritual climate and so on. But the number of local congregations where reformed preaching was heard was growing. I must also add another thing. From 1807 to 1860, there was the obligation to give out at least one hymn in a service. Many Orthodox ministers just gave out one hymn every Lord's morning and every Lord's evening. And some always choose the same hymn. They always gave out, "I glory in free grace alone." And even in that case, it could happen that most of the congregation did not join in the singing because they preferred exclusive psalmody. We have organs in our congregation, then it could happen that only the organ played the melody and the congregation listened silent to the playing. Didn't sing. When, in 1860, the obligation to sing at least one hymn in every service was revoked, there were quite soon 200 congregations in the National Church on a total number of 1,500 exclusively singing psalms. A number that grew in the 20th century to about 400. I must say that also in congregations where hymns were sung, you could in some cases hear a biblical preaching. But especially in the 20th century, a fully reformed preaching and the use of exclusive use of psalmody in congregations were actually in all cases connected, perhaps a very rare exceptions. I already explained why many reformed Christians didn't follow Kuyper. What we see after the Second World War is that reformed churches in the Netherlands that had already lost the experimental emphasis were growing in a more liberal direction, often passing by the national church. But what we see that there came a completely liberal wing in the reformed churches in the Netherlands. Several Christians left that church. But there came a great kind of agreement between the middle group and the left group in the national church and the greatest part, almost the whole of the reformed churches in the Netherlands. And so it came to a church union in 204. The national church united with the reformed churches in the Netherlands.
2004,
yeah. And also with a little Lutheran church. Accepting a new constitution, not only the Reformed confessions, but also the Lutheran confessions, a kind of Barthian statement, and also a somewhat liberal statement that said that the differences between the Lutheran and Reformed confessions were not really important. And at the same time, the giving a blessing to homosexual relationship that happened already both in the Reformed churches in the Netherlands and in the National Church, but it was given for the first time an official place in church order. All the local congregations were given the freedom not to say no. Now, a remnant to which I belong did not enter the union, and We continued as the restored Reformed Church. We lost most of its possessions. The courts of the government did not recognize our claim. I must also say that still in the Protestant Church in the Netherlands, there are really Reformed Christians. Although I must say, one of the things that made possible this union was that the Reformed wing itself in the National Church was... influenced by all kinds of liberal teaching. That was one of the things that made this union possible. Church leaders realized that. That there would not be given a strong no. Although a minority, when the complete reformed Britain had said no, the union would never have been realized. You understand? But they felt that influence of Karl Barth and all lot of things were felt in reformed circles in the national church. Still, I must say, and we must be glad about it, that in the Union Church, the Protestant Church of the Netherlands, you have on the local level faithful priests, faithful ministers and Christians. What is their argument? Although the Constitution is not longer sound, we have full freedom to preach the gospel and full freedom to disagree with the blessing of homosexual relationship. This is a portrait of the church, complex church situation in the Netherlands. I come to a conclusion. You see, it is a complex situation. We cannot say that the Lord is just working in one denomination and not working in the other denomination. With regard to the Union of 2004, you cannot say all things were done in the proper way by the man who formed the restored Reformed Church. There is always world and unholy zeal. What we can say is this, that Christ protect his church. What we see in all denominations, even the most orthodox and hyper-Calvinistic denominations in the Netherlands, there is the great danger of conformity to the world. In former days you saw differences between congregations in practice of how they live, but now we see conformity to the world in all denominations. The social media are a blessing, but also a great danger. There is cult orthodoxy, there is the influence of liberal theology, but there is still faithful preaching. And there are conversions, and there are young men, faithful young men, preparing for the ministry. There is fellowship between ministers and Christians of several denominations, especially between ministers of the Restored Reformed Church and the more right-wing of the Christian Reformed Church, but also of Reformed congregations, and I can also remember other denominations. And then you feel a unity. I pray for revival in a preaching in which Christ is portrayed as a complete Savior. And when this preaching is really blessed, the result will be that people walk in godliness and are eager to win people for Christ. And I hope and pray for more outward church unity, but I think that the church without spot or wrinkle will not be found on earth before Christ comes back. And we must never forget that the church is already one in Christ. And I'm deeply convinced that the Reformed Confession is the most truthful summary of biblical methods, of the biblical message, and the deepest expression of the Christian faith. And so I hope of a revival, in what way or other, of the Reformed Church of the Netherlands, more inward unity in the first place, and perhaps in the second place, more outward unity. That's what I will say.